From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, one of the top tournament directors in the world of poker, Matt Savage, in a conversation I had with him this weekend out in Los Angeles. Also stories from two poker road trips that each of the hosts took separately this weekend. As we roll into show number 155 of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Hello, I am Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table of the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is up to $40,000. And this weekend, somebody won a seat in the World Series of Poker main event. They have started their double shootout qualifiers for the year. And I'll tell you more about that a little bit later on. Meanwhile, my partner Dennis Phillips is back home in Las Vegas after a weekend in Oklahoma. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, I'm enjoying the weather out here. It's actually warming up a little bit, a little nice. They got a little rain, but it's pretty cool right now. And just relaxing, trying to get caught back up. It's been a hectic year so far.
Yeah, you have really been on the road a lot between the PCA and the trip down to Choctaw, Oklahoma for the World Series of Poker circuit event. I hear that they had a kind of big field this weekend.
Kind of big field? Last year they had 808 and were tickled to death with it. This year, after Black Friday, all this other stuff, they didn't know for sure. They ended up with about 980, I think it was, in their main event.
Wow.
A huge field down there. And a number of notables were down there, too. Kenny Lambert is the gentleman who runs the room down there, and he invited some of us, myself included, to come down there. But Scotty Wynn was there. Todd Bronson was there. Chad Brown was there. Ming the Master was there. Tom McAvoy was there. TJ Cloutier was there. Just a ton of different people were there, and a lot of good games. You'd love some of the cash games.
Did you guys do a meet and greet or anything? Did they push you to work while you were there?
We did a little meet and greet. Did an autograph session. It was my second trip down there. I was down there for the Native American Casino Tour that they had last fall. So this is my second trip back there. If you've never been to it, it's about an hour and a half north of Dallas. It's in Durant, Oklahoma, just across the border from Texas. And since you can't play Texas Hold'em in Texas, it's about the closest place you can go.
Yep.
And just a ton of people from Dallas and that area that journeyed up there for the circuit event.
Now, I know that they're doing this for other circuit events, but was this one also a re-entry event?
It was a re-entry event, and the way they did it was... if you played the first session, which started at 11 and got knocked out at 7 o'clock that night, they started session B, and you could re-sign up for that.
Mm.
Now, you're limited to only one sign-up. The other option you had was actually sign up sometime before noon of day two, and you came into day two with your 20,000 starting chips. That's 20 big blinds, because the levels at that time would have been 500 and 1,000. So if you wanted to, you didn't even have to play the first day. Not sure of anybody that took that choice, but it is an option.
Yeah, that's one of those things where you go, why don't I wait till the beginning of day two? And the answer is right there. You're only going to have 20 big blinds.
Correct. Yeah. And it's a fairly aggressive field in the way people play right now. If you don't win the first couple of hands with 20 big blinds, you're definitely in shove mode. No other choice.
Yeah. So when they do something like that where they do two runs of it in one day, one at 11 a.m. and one at 7 p.m., is the first one done before the second one starts, or has the field just winnowed down so much that they have room to start a second one up?
You can do it either way. This one they actually structured such that it would be over. They were only playing 9 levels on day one. They were 40-minute levels, so it's only 6 hours of actual playing. So when you start at 11, even with breaks in between, by 6 o'clock, they were done a little before 6. It gives plenty of time for the dealers to grab something to eat and come back at 7 o'clock and start again.
And so
then structured and run very well.
And so those people only played until about 1 o'clock in the morning, and so everybody could be well-rested when day two started.
Correct.
That's interesting. I kind of like doing it that way, particularly if you're in a facility that doesn't have, 100 tables that they can devote to poker tournaments. I don't know how big the room is down there at Choctaw or whether they were doing it in a ballroom or a separate other facility, but I think you're going to see other smaller facilities moving to things like that where they have 1A, 1B, and 1C, not necessarily all being on different days.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a variety of different ways. People are trying to figure out the best way to do this rebuy structure. I mean, it's here to stay. Almost all of the tournaments, the smaller tournaments especially, are using that. It gives somebody that gets, runs into some sort of a cooler a chance to get back into it. I mean, if you journey to a place like Durand, Oklahoma, you don't want to play an hour, get coolered with kings versus aces, and be done. You want a chance to come back in if possible.
Yep.
And this allows that. Plus, it's a benefit for the people running it. It'll increase the prize pool anywhere from like 8 to 12% typically from people rebuying. Therefore, it's a larger cash pool, larger prizes, more revenue for the casino, a second chance for the players, just a wide variety of things.
Now,
so I think it's kind of a win-win situation.
Now, I mentioned that later on this hour, in about 25 minutes or so, I'm going to run an interview that I did with Matt Savage at the Commerce Casino this weekend, where he was starting up his L.A. Poker Classic, and I'll tell you about some of the numbers from there, which were astounding as well. But I started the conversation with him talking about this little kind of controversy about re-entry events, and since we'll hear what he has to say on it later, I'm curious about your take. There's a piece in the January issue of Card Player magazine, right up on the front of the magazine, about this, about how some pros think that it gives pros more of an advantage because they're probably going to have deeper pockets, a bigger bankroll, so that if they come to an event like that, a $1,600 event or anything else that has multiple entry opportunities, they can actually play a much more aggressive style on their first buy-in, knowing that if they blow it up, they can always get back in the tournament, not in the way you used to do with rebuys, but with a re-entry where you go back and you get a complete new starting stack and a complete new starting day or time. What do you think? Does it give either the people with bigger bankrolls or the better pros more of an edge over, let's say, a recreational player who may have satellited in?
Well, it has several levels here, and you brought up a couple of them that I think are legit. When you get down toward the end of your day one, your first entry or whatever, however it's you want to say it, and you're fairly short stacked, then you have that option of being extremely aggressive and either doubling up or getting knocked out. So you don't have to come back for day two a very short stack if you have the funds to be able to buy in again, obviously. I've talked to a couple of other pros who like it for a different reason. They like it because normally the people that bust out early in the first two, three, four levels of a tournament are some of the weaker players, and they love having them buy back in a second time. I don't know whether there's a lot of different ideas behind this. Maybe we haven't seen exactly what it's going to filter down to because it's only really been going on for the last year with all these re-entries. In my opinion, though, a good, solid player will have a better chance to accumulate chips if he plays prudent on this first one, because you need to be able to identify the people that are trying to go out to get a big stack or go busted and play against them accordingly. If you run into that cooler, it gives you a chance to get back in. It just brings a different element to the game, and I think you need to analyze your own playing style and see how you can exploit that.
Yeah, my feeling on it, having made a couple of day twos in the last few months, but not having tremendously deep runs, I cashed, but I didn't have tremendously deep runs. My view on it is I'm only going to buy in once. If you want to buy in twice to the thing that I'm buying in once to, that's fine with me. You want to put twice as much money into a tournament as I'm going to put into a tournament, that's an overlay for me, and it's going to grow the field, and it's going to grow the prize pool, and I'm only going to be in there once. If I bust out, I'm happy to go play the cash games. If you bust out and you want to rebuy, that's fine. If I play day, like last year when I was down in Florida, and I played day 1B of their circuit event down there, fully 40 to 50% of the 1B field was people who had busted out of 1A. Now, either they're not great players who were going to give it another shot, and that's fine with me, or they are good players who were playing too aggressively or whatever, or maybe they got coolered, whatever it was. But by the time I get in there, their money from day A is now completely dead money. I'm competing with them with my 1B money and their 1B money, but they also have their 1A money that's in the prize pool that's dead money. that's an overlay for me, and I'm happy about that.
And that is a good way to look at it. Again, you need to analyze your own play and how you want to do this and how you can best exploit this new version of Texas Hold'em. That's pretty much what it is a new version of it.
Right. So anyway, you'll hear what Matt Savage had to say about it in about 20 minutes or so here on the show. Anything else from Oklahoma we need to talk about before I get into my California weekend?
Well, I just was very pleased with the way it was run. Jimmy Sommerfeld was down there. Got to sit down and have a meal with him and talk to him for a while. He has, now get this, I thought I had a busy schedule. I thought I was spending a couple hundred days a year in hotels and, you know, woe be to me and all these airline miles I do.
Yep.
Jimmy spends over 300 days of the year in hotels.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's sick.
Yep.
You know, he's never at home in doing this thing. He's dedicated to making it one of the best ones around, and by doing that, you need to be hands-on, and that's exactly what he's done for a long, long time. And I can see, if you're spending 320 or whatever it is days in a hotel during the year, that doesn't give you a whole lot of time to spend with your family.
You can understand why after 18 years of that, he's hanging it up at the end of next month, wants to spend time closer to home. He's got a new grandchild. And you know, he'll still be traveling a little bit, and he'll still be involved in things, but not to that level. And so good for him, and thanks to him for all the years that he's put in for that.
It absolutely is. And to give him a little bit of a plug, he's going to be down in the Memphis area. He's going to be around Tunica. He has his own auction service that's going to be starting up as soon as he finishes up his obligations here in the poker world. He's going to be running twice a week auctions down there, one of them a very high end, one of them more like estates and such like that. He'll be able to spend virtually every night at home with his family and relax and enjoy and just have some much needed fun and relaxation, I guess is what you'd say.
Good for him. That's great.
I think so. Absolutely.
All right, so that's what happened with Dennis at the WSOP Choctaw this weekend at the Choctaw Casino in Oklahoma. Meanwhile, I was on a road trip of my own to California where Matt Savage was running the L.A. Poker Classic, which is one of the longer poker series of the year. It runs nearly as long as the World Series of Poker does. It's about 6 weeks. And as I mentioned last week, he was starting it off with a $65 buy-in tournament with a $100,000 guarantee, meaning after you take out the fees that the casino's taken out of that, the rake, essentially you had to have at least 2,000 people enter this tournament. There were going to be four day ones, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D. He had more than 2,000 people by 1C. Ended up with 3,333 people, which means that the prize pool was over 150,000, which means that first place was probably a little over $30,000. Not a bad return for your $65. Or maybe you bought in twice and it was $130. $30,000 return on that is a pretty good return.
This is just getting amazing. They've got the circuit event down in West Palm Beach where they've got the $1 million guarantee for that one.
Yeah.
For the one event, the $300 one.
Yep.
From what I'm hearing, everybody and their brothers going down to that, they could blow right past that. I really think a lot of tournament directors need to start looking at these guarantees and make one that's, you know, fairly safe, that they're fairly reasonable they're going to reach. Just by throwing out that guarantee, it seems to entice a certain group of people to attend it.
Absolutely. I do need to correct you on one thing. The one in Florida is a 555 buy-in.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. But that's still going to take a ton of players down there to get $1 million in the prize pool.
Yep. Couple thousand will have to do it.
Yep, absolutely.
So not only was Matt running that at Commerce, but also on, I think it was on Saturday, he ran a Facebook tournament. For anybody who was a Commerce Casino fan, who liked Commerce Casino online, you were eligible to play in essentially what was, you know, another $50 or $60 tournament. And they had 734 people show up for that on the same day as one of the flights for this 100K guaranteed tournament. So when anybody tells you, oh, live poker is really suffering, no, live poker is thriving, and live tournament poker is thriving all over the country. We see record-breaking numbers everywhere. I expect them to have huge numbers here in April when the circuit comes to Harrah's St. Louis.
It absolutely is. And this is something that you would really appreciate. The PLO down there in Choctaw, 340 people in a PLO tournament down there.
That's pretty good.
That's very, very good.
Yeah. Awesome. I actually was able to get a PLO game started at Commerce on Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening. I was playing in a 5-10 table, and there were certainly plenty of those there. Not only are there tournament players there, but lots of cash game players. Plus, you know, Monday was Chinese New Year, so this weekend was kind of like a New Year's weekend for a lot of Asian players in the L.A. area. So they were out in huge numbers, and I actually was able to get a 5-5 PLO game going there. They do not run that game regularly, but we were able to get it going, I think, about eight-handed late on Saturday, and it ran well past midnight that night. So I'm just doing my best to spread PLO wherever I can, in addition to playing it here at Harrah's St. Louis, where the game goes 7 days a week. If you've never been to Commerce, by the way, biggest card room in America. If you're playing in one of the games that's 5-10 or higher, you're going to get free food, and the food is terrific there. I think you can get food service everywhere, but it's free for you in those games. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, you can eat all three meals there, and it's pretty darn good. And they've got masseuses there, and good game choice and whatever you want to play. I don't like one thing. They don't allow the straddle there. We're very familiar with the straddle here, and including the button straddle, which is our version of kind of the mini Mississippi straddle here in St. Louis. No straddling in the 5-10 games out there, even under the gun. You can make it a blind raise, but you can't put $20 out there as a live straddle. I haven't seen that before anywhere.
Well, that actually brings up something else that they do down at Choctaw that I've never seen anywhere else. A different version of the straddle. They call it the Dallas straddle. What it is, it can only be for the button or under the gun. Button has priority. You are guaranteed last action preflop, period. So it skips you. It goes starts under the gun, the normal person, goes around, skips you, does a small blind and big blind, and then if there's a raise and a re-raise and a re-raise and a re-re-raise and a five bet and a whatever the heck it is, till two people get all in preflop, you just sit there and watch it and then get to look at your cards and make a decision.
Wow. See, now, normally when you have a button straddle, the small blind acts first. And so the button would, of course, get last action in that round normally. But in yours, what you're talking about is a button straddle where the blinds don't act and the guy under the gun has first action. It goes around, it jumps over the button straddle, and then the blinds act, and then the button has last action.
Well, button has last action, period. So that is the normal one, and normally then he would act right after the big blind. But had there been a raise or a say somebody raises under the gun, folds all the way around to the big blind, and he re-raises, it goes back to the gentleman who was under the gun then. And then if he raises again, it goes back to the big blind. And the button guy just sits there and watches them until they're all done bidding.
What a fantastic time to wake up with aces on the button. Wow.
Yeah.
That's one I'd never heard of.
I have never either. I'm not too sure I really like it, to be honest about it, but it gives a tremendous amount of power to the button.
Yeah.
And if you're involved in a game like that and you don't straddle on the button, you better put in for a table move.
You know what? I don't think I would like that.
Just
thinking about it, I think it gives the button too much power.
Yeah, it is a tremendous amount of power.
I prefer to have the button straddle means that the small blind acts first. So you still just go clockwise in the regular order, and when it comes back around to the button, you act in turn. You're still going to get last action. That's what I'm used to, so that's what I like. While I was out there also on Friday night, our friends Bart Hansen and Dave Tuckman, who we had that show with last fall, that is still now our most downloaded podcast of the Final Table Poker Show ever, they do a thing at the Bicycle Club in L.A. that you're familiar with called Live at the Bike. This is a webcast of a live cash game that they do for about 3 hours online Tuesday nights and Friday night. And this past Friday night, I signed up for the game. Bart actually put me up on the board on Thursday afternoon, and I got into the game on Friday night, and it was very interesting playing in this, particularly because they had just brought out their new RFID table. Here's what that means. Normally, when you watch a webcast of a cash game with hole cards, or a live broadcast, or the World Poker Tour, or the WSOP, or any of the other poker shows that have been on the air for the last 10 years, the way you know what each player has is they pick up their cards and they show them to the little camera built into the side of the table. They're showing it to the camera so the cards can see them, and you as the viewer can see them right there on the screen as they look at them. Sometimes they don't show all of them on screen, but you get to see what they are with a graphic that appears on the screen based on what that camera sees. With the RFID table, there are no cameras on the table. Even going back to the days of late night poker on British television, which I think was the first one to ever do hole cards with a game, they used to have cameras under the table looking up through smoked glass, and the players would have to separate their cards and put them on there, and the cameras would recognize them from underneath. Again, with the RFID table, there are no cameras built into the table. Instead, the cards have RFID chips in them. And when you hold the cards over a certain spot in front of you, and it's designated by a little gray circle in front of each player, when you hold it over that, the table recognizes what the cards are and sends the information electronically to the booth where Bart and Dave can see it, and it automatically goes up on the graphics on the screen. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, well, that's not safe. If the table can see it because there's a chip in there, somebody's going to figure out a way to scam that and rip off the information and pass it on to the other players, and so somebody at the table will be able to know what somebody else has. No problems with that yet, although it's fairly early technology, but I predict that you're going to see this in a lot more televised events because now they don't have to have the little lipstick cameras in the side of the table to do it. You just use these cards, and the table knows what everybody has. It knows when each person folds, takes the graphics off of the screen, and will make life enormously easier for the TV production crews behind the scene. Have you ever done anything with anything like that?
I have, actually. I've played at those tables a couple of different times. The last time was in Boston when I went out there to do a charity event, and it was for the Eastern Poker Tour that runs up and down through New Hampshire and Massachusetts and in Boston area and that. And they had one of the big tables there. It was their featured table in the charity tournament. So I got to sit there and play it. And there was a guy behind the screen, 20 feet from it, that could literally pull it up on his computer, and it would have everybody's hand and calculate everybody's percentage of winnings and the whole bit.
Yep.
It was a technology leapfrog forward. I mean, just huge. I sat in the booth with him a while after I got knocked out of the tournament and watched it, and it was just amazing. All the information is instantly there in front of you. And you talk about being a Monday night quarterback. I can sit there and tell everybody exactly how to play real quick.
Now, here's something interesting. When the bike put this table in, they ordered the cards with the RFID chips in them. The card manufacturer didn't understand what they were for, and they sent them bridge cards instead of poker cards. So the cards are actually a little bit wider, and what that meant was they didn't fit in the shuffler. Now, I don't know if RFID chipped cards can go in a regular shuffler anyway, but they certainly can't go if they don't fit. So that meant that the dealers had to hand shuffle, which slowed the game down just a little bit. But still, it was a lot of fun. I played for about 2 hours and 10, maybe 2 hours and 15 minutes, made a nice little profit. And then Bart and Dave wanted me to come in the back and join them in the booth and do some live commentary, and I did so. If you want to see that, you can go to liveatthebike.com, and you can join, get a membership for free, which allows you to watch any of the Live at the Bike broadcasts for the next 2 weeks. And so this is the one from last Friday that I played in, and a couple of interesting hands I was involved in. First 20, 25 minutes or so, I kind of sat back, and we should talk about this for a couple of minutes. When you go out of town and you're playing against players you don't know, everybody else at the table knew each other. They were all locals. I was the out-of-town guy. When you're in that situation, Dennis, do you kind of sit back and check things out before you jump into the pool?
If you can, I absolutely do. I'll sit there and I'll fold for a round the table and kind of get a general read on the players and how they're doing it. What you hate is when you get one of those danger hands and somebody, like, you know, you get pocket jacks and somebody tree bets you. And you look over at the guy, and he's a 70-year-old guy with a nice, neat set up in a whole bit like that, and you're not for sure how to play, but you assume he must have a monster. And then you find out 20 minutes later that this guy plays every hand and three bets every other time. But, you know, it can really get you in trouble at the very beginning until you analyze your table. And the quicker you can get the read on the table, the quicker you can see what kind of how they're playing, the better it is for you, obviously.
Yep. I think that you have to do that. You know, if it's people that you play with all the time, everybody knows how everybody plays. And so it's really on you to decide when you're going to mix it up and change. You know, don't go fastball all the time. Don't go curveball all the time. You got to throw different pitches every once in a while in a baseball game, and the same thing at a poker table. But particularly if you travel and you go to tournaments in other cities and you bust out of them and then you end up in a cash game, you may look around at the other 8 or 9 players and you've never played a hand with any of them. Now, it's different if you're Dennis Phillips because they all know you. And so they know something about you while you know nothing about them. In this situation, you're just as anonymous to them as they are to you, but it's important for you to take that time at the beginning to gather information. Who are these guys? I profile them when I sit down, as Dennis has talked about in the past. What kind of person, what do they look like? Are they neat? Are they young? Are they old? Are they, you know, what do they look like they're going to be? Do they look like they're going to be an aggressive player or a passive player? But you can only verify that by the information that you garner by watching every hand, paying attention to how people play. In all these hands that you're folding, you should be gathering information. That's the only way you're going to determine how you're going to play when you do jump into it. And it may be only 10 minutes, it may be 20 or 30 minutes that it takes you to figure out who's who at that table and what you can do. Can you 3-bet this guy light and make him lay down a hand? Can you make a move on another guy? I got involved in a hand against an older guy who was more of a rock where 3 hearts came out. I had raised with ace-queen with the queen of hearts. He had ace-queen with the ace of hearts. I c-bet the flop, he called, but when I c-bet the turn, he laid it down. That's the kind of player he was. He wasn't going to keep going for his flush draw on a jack-high 3-heart board because that's who he is, and I had known that because I'd played with him for the last 20 or 30 minutes and watched how he played. That's such a vital piece of strategy that you need more in cash games, but certainly in tournaments where you're sitting down with a lot of people you don't know all the time.
You absolutely do. And in a tournament, what happens is, you know, as the tables consolidate and you move from table to table to table, you have to be able to do that. There can be times in a tournament when you might be in 6 or 7 tables in the same day. And if it takes you a long time to analyze your table and to adjust your play, you're going to be hurting.
Yep.
You have to sit down, make an instant analysis, and then find out if you were correct or not.
Yep. So there's more of an opportunity to study people in cash games.
Absolutely.
Because there's no ante, there's no... the blinds aren't going up. You're not in any rush. If you're playing a 5-10 game, blinds are 5-10 now, they'll be 5-10 in a half hour. They'll be 5-10 in 3 hours. It's going to stay that way, and you don't have that pressure of the rising blinds threatening your chip stack.
Yep, absolutely. Cash games are so much different than tournaments. I love when you sit down with a guy and he says, oh, there's no difference. Poker is poker. I want to play with that guy.
One more plug for our friends Bart and Dave at Live at the Bike. Tonight, there's going to be a live PLO game on there, which I think is terrific because, again, the more people who watch PLO, the more people who will play PLO, you will be able to learn it. These guys both know how to play it. And with that RFID table, it'll be much easier for them to get all 4 cards up on the screen that each player is holding, and you'll really be able to see it. So liveatthebike.com, it starts at 7:30 Pacific time, which is 9:30 Central time. And you can watch it. Usually the webcasts are about 3 hours long. They do it on Tuesdays and Fridays, and tonight is going to be a PLO night. We have to take a break here, and then we're going to come back with Matt Savage, the tournament director from the other card club in L.A., the big one, the Commerce Casino. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. We're brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis, which has got the new bounty tournaments coming up next month. Dennis, I don't know if you've heard about this. Next month, every Tuesday, is going to be bounty tournament night here at Harrah's. It's a $100 buy-in, $25 bounty awarded to every player who busts another player. So you bust 4 people out of the tournament, you get your buy-in back, and essentially you're free-rolling there. You'll start with $10,000 in chips, and the blinds will be about 20 minutes. They'll be doing it every Tuesday in February, except for Valentine's Day. on Valentine's Day, they're going to do another Jack and Jill tournament. This was very popular during the Gateway Poker Classic here in December. This will be a team of one man and one woman, or one woman and one man.
Okay.
It depends on, you know, how things go in your house. Who gets listed first, him or her, or her or him? That'll be a $100 buy-in, and again, 7 o'clock on Valentine's Day. Also next month, more chances for you to satellite into the World Series of Poker main event and the World Series of Poker circuit main event that'll be here in April. We'll tell you more about those as we roll towards February. If you want more information, you can go to harrisstlouis.com. And don't forget, this weekend also, the big $15,000 buy-in, Big Game 2. That's the 25-50 no-limit game with a $10 ante. It was so successful at the end of October. We're running it again this weekend. It starts Friday night at 6. We have people flying in from all over to be a part of this. A lot of locals will be a part of it as well. If you want to come and play in some of the other cash games in the room and watch the Big Game 2, we're going to be playing it right by the front window, so you can check it out there. And there'll also be a 10-20 game going on at the same time. If that's your level of play, you're welcome to get into both of those. We have details on all of this on our website, which is thechipleader.com. Just click on the Final Table Radio Show, and you'll find out what you need to know. We're back with more in a moment on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis in the World Series of Poker Room. My partner Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. We're available on every smartphone made in the world now, either on your iPhone via iTunes or on your Android phone via Stitcher. Stitcher is actually available for all smartphones now. Download that app, and you can get the Final Table Poker Show anywhere. You can also follow us on Twitter, Dennis_Phillips, or Paul Harris Show. I should say and, not or. You can follow both of us online. So now let's get to my conversation from this weekend with Matt Savage. He's really one of the top guys in the business, isn't he, Dennis, along with Jimmy Sommerfeld?
Absolutely. Tremendous respect for him. He has it among everybody in the poker community. You just know when you go to one of his tournaments that it's going to be well-run, well-organized, and you're going to be able to get a lot of playing in.
Matt runs tournaments for the World Poker Tour and the Epic Poker League and Bay 101 and Commerce Casino, where they had the LAPC this weekend. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we talked about was this controversy over re-entry events. Roll it, Jason.
When we started those re-entry tournaments back here in 2010 with the million-dollar guarantee, I think it was 2009 even, the million-dollar guarantee, I designated it a way where for the casino, you're bringing people back every day. And now it's kind of altered. A lot of other places are doing re-entry the same day. They're doing re-entries where you can combine the chips. And to me, I don't think that makes as much sense for the casino. I don't think it makes as much sense for the players. And the reason I think that is I just think you're burning up everybody's money in one day. You know, the goal of the tournaments at the beginning was to bring people into your casino. And I think we do it by allowing you to re-enter the following day. It gives people an opportunity, if they can't make it a certain day, to come back in, or, you know, if they bust out on a bad beat, to also re-enter. So I am a fan of the re-entry events, but I think some of the ways they're doing them, some of the way they're being operated, are becoming a little out of control. It's becoming a little bit too close to a rebuy event, and that's something that I'm trying to get away from.
All right, let's explain for our listeners who may not know what all these terms mean. What's the difference between re-entry and rebuy, and what do you mean when you say they can come back the next day and some places do it same day? Explain the details.
Well, a rebuy event basically is you can, when you get short on chips or below a certain amount of chips, you can add to your stack. And what that does is it favors the people with the deep pockets. The people that are in the tournament, they can rebuy as many times as they want. It doesn't give everybody a chance to do that. A re-entry event, on the other hand, doesn't favor the deep pockets, in my opinion, because if you bust out, now you can come back in the next day and play. You're starting all fresh all over again. So it's like a brand new tournament, but we do it here with big guarantees to try and have those small guys have a chance at big money. And I think that way, if everybody's starting on the same footing with the re-entry, it's fair to all.
Do you make it so that they can only re-enter if they go bust, or could somebody who has a short stack at the end of 1A come back, start again on 1B, and then if they bust out on 1B, well, at least they still have their 1A stack?
Yeah, we've debated that, and I put a thread on 2+2 just about that. What I do here is that if you bust out on day one, A, if you make it through day 1A, you have a chance to come back the next day and try and get a better stack. If you get that better stack, you're already in the money for the first stack, so you're going to cash there, and then you can pick the bigger of the two stacks. So then that way, you know, you're already guaranteed some money, so I think that that's a fair way to do it as well.
Do you think that some of the people who are coming and planning on rebuying, they're going to play 2 days, 3 days, 4 days of a reentry event like that, are playing really fast early on to get those chips because they figure, well, what the heck, I'm going to blow off. I planned on budgeting 3 or 4 days worth of this, so if I blow off the first buy-in, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that might be a strategy of some. I don't think it's a strategy of all, but I think that's a strategy of some, and that's what poker is about to me, different strategies. So, you know, it opens it up so you can do different things and play differently for the event.
What do you think that does for a recreational player who, you know, $65 is one thing. For some people, that may be all they can really afford to do. But when you get into bigger events, particularly a main event of a circuit that they're doing this year on the WSOP circuit, they're doing $1,600 mains with a 1A and a 1B. So you think that hurts some of those recreational players?
Well, I think it opens it up to where those players are going to play worse. They're not going to play better. So, I mean, it may be to their advantage if somebody's going to, you know, tighten up a little bit and play a little, you know, snugger, because you know that the people are going to be out there and being aggressive and gambling. It might be easier for them.
I mentioned at the top here that you not only do stuff for Commerce Casino, but you're also the tournament director for the World Poker Tour and for Epic Poker League. First, let's talk about WPT. You're in the midst of a season right now. Where are you in that season, and how's it going?
It's going great so far. I mean, the numbers are up pretty much across the board. We are now in our 10th season. I'm the executive tour director, so I oversee kind of the whole tour, and it's been exciting. I mean, there's a lot of new stops on the tour. We're at Jacksonville. We're at, you know, the Parks Casino. We have the standby tournaments, like here in L.A. We have the bike and the Commerce, and we have our Commerce event coming up. We're going back to Bay 101 after this, Seminole Hard Rock. I'm also the tournament director there, as well as Bay 101. So there's a lot of unique and great stops coming up that I'm excited about, and obviously the international growth as well. I think that our European international side of things for the World Poker Tour is growing, expanding, and I think the player base is expanding there as well, which makes it exciting for us, obviously, as a tour.
It seems to me, from watching your tournaments and many of the others, that tournament poker has exploded since Black Friday. Is that online money that's now coming and playing live?
Yeah, I think there is definitely some people that are coming out of their house and playing live land-based tournaments. And I just think it's, you know, it's interesting, and I hate the fact that some of the players have to leave the United States to play online, and I'm hoping that will change in the near future. But at the same time, I think that, you know, it does give people a reason to come out to the local card room.
Yeah, and they are doing that.
And they are doing that, and I actually think that's the way poker should be played. And I think a lot of those guys feel the same way as well.
So your numbers on the WPT are big wherever you go, and you're expanding into other markets. And are we going to see you on some of the TV coverage like we did last year?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be involved in that. I'm doing the final table interviews. One of the toughest jobs, because I don't get to do retakes like others do. And I also have to talk to the people that just busted out of the tournament. So a little tough at times, but, you know, I'm learning my way through it. It's been fun, obviously. Come some great interviews coming up on this season, so make sure you look out for that.
All right, tell me about the Epic Poker League, which got its launch last fall. There's been controversy about that. We don't need to go into some of the controversies, but tell me about how the tournaments have gone so far. As I understand it, you've done 3, and you've got a fourth one coming up that you had to push back because of a conflict, right?
Yeah, the dates conflict at the Palms, there wasn't really enough time for us to run Pro-Am events and satellites into the Pro-Am leading up to that, but they're working on the dates right now, and it should have an announcement very soon, but likely will be before the World Series Poker, so that's a good thing, and that's when we'll have the championship as well for the $1 million free roll. So, I mean, I've always said this, but I think that, you know, the Epic Poker League adding money to the prize pool for these pros, I think they work real hard, and they deserve opportunities like this, so they're very happy to see it. The television show's gotten great reviews, and the fact that it's on CBS is very well received, so excited about this year, and hopefully next year as well.
Now, you know as well as I do that poker players are never happy.
Fact.
I know, you're giving them $100 food certificate. You're giving them a room. You're giving them a guarantee, and you're, you know, putting money on top of the guarantee in every one of these events. What are they complaining about?
Minute things. Things they shouldn't be complaining about. And I know a friend of mine, you know, Matt Glantz, professional poker player, wrote an article about that, responsibility in poker.
And we just had Matt on last week's show.
Yeah, I truly believe that, you know, he's going in the right direction. He and I talked about it before he wrote it. He kind of asked me my opinion. I said, you know, sure, right. I think it's a great idea. Obviously, we have the same ideology on that type of thing. And, you know, I think that the younger players are learning. I think the younger players are great. They're great for the game. It's exciting to see so many new players coming onto the scene. But I think that they need to be responsible in what they do outside of poker, even when they're on the poker table. So I'd like to see some of that, you know, sink into those guys, and I think it has.
When Matt was on with us last week, we were talking about it, especially younger poker pros, guys in their early 20s, who act badly, and maybe there aren't repercussions for them right away, and other young players see that and say, oh, this is how I'm supposed to act. Right. Do you think we're losing some role models in the process here, or is just the explosion of poker in the last decade or so given us a new breed of players who don't quite understand the history of poker and the responsibility of poker?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I feel like some of the tradition has gone from the game, and I think that's unfortunate. You know, there's, you know, just a deep tradition, you know, and I know that Doyle, when he spoke at his lifetime achievement, felt that. I could feel it in him, and I know it hurt him, that, you know, a lot of the battles that he fought to get up there and be where he is today in the poker world have kind of been lost on the younger generation. But I think it's unfortunate, but I think that, you know, if you look, and I think they will come in, and they're going to create their own new tradition. I think that a lot of these guys up and coming are superstars, better than, you know, the guys in the past. And, you know, while the game is changing all the time, I think these guys are going to adapt, and I think it's going to make for a bright future for the game itself. And, you know, the fact that they're playing other games is super exciting.
Do you get to see a lot of the poker as it's being played, or are you so caught up in being tournament director that you're watching the technical stuff, but maybe not thinking about the strategy of what players are doing?
Yeah, not enough of it sinks in, I'm afraid. I like to play myself, and, you know, while I'm not a very good player, I think that I can compete in some certain games and spots, so I like to play, and I enjoy it. I'm never bad for the game, but at the same time, I try and watch and see what's going on, but I think more of that is from the tournament director side of things.
So I guess what I'm asking is, when you're watching them, are you seeing things that you never saw before? Because you've been in the business a few years.
Oh, yeah.
Are you seeing players playing at a level that's different from what you're familiar with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, before there was, you know, when people threw in a minimum raise, we would laugh at them and say, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. Now, it's commonplace. So the 3, 4, 5 bets pre-flop that you never saw before happen all the time. So it's really transformed the game. Guys out there playing these $65 tournaments have not seen that yet. But I think a lot of these guys someday will. And I think it's going to be an interesting transition for them to get to that spot.
Yeah, the few times that I've played low buy-in tournaments, and you have somebody who isn't a young gun, maybe it's a middle-aged guy who's, you know, he plays recreationally and doesn't play a lot of events, and you can tell he's got a big hand because the blinds are 50 and 100 and he makes it 850.
Right.
When the young guys at the table are making it 2 and a quarter. Yeah. Gee, I wonder what he has.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you'd see it. I mean, a lot of times, and, you know, I've been pretty vocal about it. I'm not a huge fan of deep stack tournaments because I don't think the players that play them understand what they're all about. Matter of fact, I've talked to it on a year show before. You know, I can make a tournament with 20,000 in chips last, you know, 4 hours. I can make a tournament with 1,000 in chips like I do with the e-tournament that we do here last 2 full days. So, you know, the amount of chips you start with is not as important as people make it out to be. But at the same time, you will see people with big and deep stack tournaments going all in the first level anyway. So, you know, how you play those chips mean a lot more than how many you get.
Tell me about payouts, because there's another little bit of controversy in the last year to year and a half about flattening things out so that people at the bottom end are getting a little bit more and people at the top are getting a little bit less. Is that because people are spending too many hours at the table and not getting enough return and they were complaining about that, or why has that been happening?
Well, I think some of that is that. I mean, obviously, flattening out payouts has been around. I mean, people have been advocates for that for years. And, you know, when I started in this industry, you pay one table. Pretty much that was it. You know, didn't matter how many players you had. And obviously spreading that out is good for not only players, but it's also good for the casinos, because now people have money to come back and play the next day. And, you know, there was a controversy at Bellagio paying 100 spots. Again, I wrote another post about that. Is it bad for the game, or is it just bad because you don't like it? You know, basically that was the gist of it. And, you know, a lot of the people that cashed in that tournament complained because because they only made a very small amount of money. But were the backers complaining about it? Not necessarily. Were the players at Cash complaining about it? Only the top pros. Those other ones that made their first cash in a World Poker Tour event were saying, wow, I just cashed in the World Poker Tour event. Hey, I might go play at the LAPC. I understand that now I can do it, and so now maybe I go try next door, or maybe I'll go try, you know, the Bay 101 on the next stop on the World Poker Tour, and it because they cashed in the first one. So, you know, is it terrible? Maybe. Is it, you know, might be okay, too.
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of it being terrible. It's just a matter of, is it good for that individual player?
Right.
I have found that as a cash game player, many times with a flat payout, it turns out to be negative EV for me to stay in a tournament when there's a big cash game going on downstairs. Right. I don't want to have to stick around here and beat 150 more people to move up $50
in
payout.
You say that around here, and it hurts my feelings when you say that, because here at the Commerce, you know, we have more cash games than anywhere else in the country.
Right.
And a lot of times I get phone calls from people, I'm coming in and playing all these events, and I never see them. They're downstairs playing the whole time because the cash games are so good here.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing to see, but, you know, as a tournament guy, you kind of want to see them playing the events, but at the other side, your job is to get people in to come play cash games, so it's a little give and take that we have here.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit that I'm one of those guys that you don't like all that much because I'm downstairs playing the cash games. Tell me about new kinds of tournaments. We talked about re-entry tournaments at the beginning, but we've seen things like position tournaments with extra buttons in them, or you win the button when you win the hand, and that sort of thing. What do you like that's out there? What do you not like that's out there? What would you like to try that's not even out there yet?
Well, I like turbos. No, I'm just kidding. I like a lot of the new things. Obviously, I think that any kind of innovation that's going to happen is going to make the game more interesting, keep more people involved, keep people wanting to come back and play different things. You know, like I said, here we do that e-tournament where we start with 1,000 in chips, and people say, this is impossible. You can't start with so few chips. But at the same time, you get so much play that people don't understand it. And next thing you know, they're like, this is the greatest structure ever. Mm-hmm. We started with 1,000 in chips.
How do you structure it for people who don't know?
We start with we have 2-hour levels, 1,000 in chips, and we start at, 25 and 25, goes to 25, 50, 50 and 75, 50 and 100, 75, 150, and before you know it, you've played 10 hours the first day, and you still have quarter chips in play.
Mm-hmm.
So people all of a sudden start to understand, it gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and going into day 2, you're at 100 big blinds, so it gives you much more play. Ironman tournament, which we do here, is a different style event, kind of gives you the opportunity to do that type of thing and see if you can live up to the stamina. You know, a lot of times, these deep stack tournaments last so long, it's not fair for the older guys like me and you, you know, to play in these tournaments. And you know, it becomes a match where you can, if you have the most endurance, you're going to win. I just don't think that's, you know, something that's, positive for every player. I don't think it's equal for every player. So those type of things, you know, we do an all-interfold tournament here. You know, it's a little bit gambled. Then people get in there and they say, hey, there's some strategy to this.
So, how many did you get last year in the all-interfold?
360 players.
360 players, coughed up 120 each.
Yeah.
And every time the action's on you, you have to move all in or you have to fold.
That's it. 2 options. And then it keeps it interesting. But, again, there's position you could play, or, you know, if you see somebody going all in all the time, you just wait for your hand. There's a lot of different strategy you might have in that game, but it's fun to watch because, you know, people are jumping up and down, screaming and having a great time. And I think it's something, another one of those where you don't have to be the greatest player in the world to win it.
Right.
So I think anytime an amateur player can come in and win a tournament, it's good for the whole
industry. Absolutely. We got to grow the poker industry from the bottom up. I keep saying that.
Yes.
Are you doing that again during the LAPC this year?
Yeah, we're doing that one as well.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked about some of the new things that are out there, and you've already mentioned your dislike for deep stacks. Does that mean in the next 6 weeks there's no deep stack event?
We have deep stack tournaments. Obviously, there are players that want them, and we try to accommodate everybody. We do a double stack tournament, so we've given more chips in this tournament this year than ever before, and so the double stacks will be twice as much. You know, and in my opinion, you know, I want the play to be middle and late where it matters the most. So, you know, when those tournaments come on, obviously they're going to be a little higher at the beginning to start. So there will be some of those. Another situation that I'm going to talk about is with the deep stack tournaments is people are starting to see that they're charging more and more rake. Well, that's because you can't afford to run these deep stack tournaments without raising the rake because, you know, you have to pay the employees, you have to pay the staff, you have to do it. And when you get all that play in the beginning, you have many more dealers at the table, you have much more staff that you need to accommodate all of these things, and it costs the casinos money. So I think the more and more you see people giving chips, the more you're going to see rake hype rising, and I think that's an unfortunate thing. Obviously, I'd like to see costs down for the players. Here at the Commerce, we have some of the lowest entry fees across the board, and I think to do that, we've done some things where it might be a little bit faster in the beginning, but you'll see that these are some of the greatest structures in poker.
How hard is it to get good dealers?
It's not as tough as it used to be. There's a lot of people out there looking for work, but it's hard to get good dealers because of, like I said, a lot of times the deep stack tournaments, when you run them, there's so much play in the beginning that the dealers aren't getting paid what they used to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem. So, the best dealers are finding jobs in live card rooms, and they don't want to leave it. They're happy where they're at, and they don't want to go travel and run the circuit because they're not making as much money as they used to. It's one of those things where you got some give and take, but at the same time, to weed out the dealers that are bad, I'd rather have a dealer that cares and is not maybe as technically as good and has a better attitude than somebody that has a bad attitude that might be a great dealer. So for me, it's a little bit different. I think we got a great staff here. I think we got a great staff, pretty much wherever I work. I bring some of the best dealers in the world to Epic, and you can ask those guys, they'll tell you. And I loved it for those guys to get paid when we do.
Yeah. Do you take dealers on the road with you when you do WPT events, or are you always using local people?
Occasionally, but more and more we're using the in-house casino dealers because it's just the way it is. It's one of those things where you have to fly people to a certain destination, put them up in a hotel room, pay for their travel. That type of thing is becoming less and less feasible.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, that doesn't happen as much. But, like I said, the dealers are getting better and better wherever they're at.
And you, of course, have been involved with the TDA. Last summer, there was another TDA summit, either right at the end of or just after the World Series of Poker out of the Rio. What happened last year that constitutes a change in the way you do your job or the way other tournament directors do their job to follow your lead?
We reworded some of the rules last year just to make sure that it was understood by all. A lot of times what happens in the TDA is people don't understand that, while we're running and I'm running $10,000 and $25,000 events around the world, at the same time, these rules apply to the $65 tournaments. So you got to make them fair for everybody across the board. And, one of the things we were seeing is people were coming up with all newfangled terms for poker. So that was one of the things we tried to nail down last year. There are 7 words of poker that everybody understands. Raise, call, fold, all in. Forget the rest. That's good. PokerTDA.com. Check it out. But there are words of poker that I think needed to be clarified so that when somebody said upstairs at Nelly's, you knew what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that means?
No. Upstairs at Nelly's?
That used to mean
Ray's. I know Nelly. I don't know anything about
that
upstairs at
used to
at
mean
Nelly's.
Ray's. It doesn't anymore. You have to say Ray's. We're all in.
What about just pointing your thumb up in the air?
That does not count.
Really?
No. I don't know what you're asking for. Maybe you're giving somebody the high five across the room. That doesn't count in my tournaments.
This is one of those things that comes up in Matt's Twitter feed. People
yes.
ask all the time.
Yes.
If it's folded around to somebody or it's checked around to somebody and the last person to access, okay. What does that mean? That was actually a question
yesterday. Just yesterday, yeah.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything yet. So it's one of those things that people need to learn, and you need to trade at the very basic levels. People are going to ascend from the $65 tournaments to the $10,000 events.
Right.
They need to know those things because it could be important. It could be a million-dollar decision. And like I said, I want everybody to know all the rules at all times.
And we're not just talking about online players who don't know the live poker rules, but also you got a lot of people who are playing a tournament at their Moose Lodge or in their basement or their American Legion Hall or at charity events, and they don't know that sort of stuff when they come to play in a real live tournament, what the words are and how they're supposed to act. And it's important, again, to grow that sort of stuff and teach people from the bottom up.
Yeah, I agree. And it's one of those things that, when you say that on Twitter, I know that sometimes I'm getting questions from people that are just learning the game and they're in home games, and sometimes I'm getting questions from the top pros that have a bet on this. So I just want 10%. 10%, send it to me.
10% of the pros prop bets.
Yeah, because sometimes they're as much as $10,000 are betting on a rule, and my decision counts. And they call me on the phone. They say, Matt, this is for a lot of money. Please tell me. I need to know. Give me this situation. Then the other guy gets on the phone. Well, this was the situation.
Can you think of a situation where there was money on the line?
Oh, yeah. Josh Arie calls me all the time with stuff. And Vince Napolitano.
What would be an example of a situation that they wanted to know a ruling
basic
on?
Stuff. I mean, stuff that they should know. The one chip rule. If, know, somebody gets around to the small blind, it's 1 in 200, and somebody throws out a $5,000 chip on top of it and doesn't say anything. Is it a raise? No, it's a call, because they didn't say raise. You know, well, what if they had $100 chips in back and you knew that they were going to raise? You don't know they're going to raise, so it's got to be the same for everybody. That one came up and answered it for them, and I don't know. I never got the 10%.
Last summer at the series, there was some controversy between Daniel Negreanu and some of the World Series of Poker floor people that eventually got to Jack Effel, the tournament director there, about Daniel was upset that he thought that he couldn't talk at all at the table when he was involved in a hand.
Yeah, and then he started calling me on. But, you know, it got to Jack. Jack straightened it out. You know, at the time, I think the floorman misunderstood the rule a little bit, basically said you can't talk at all. And what happened was is Jack, you know, ended up catching wind of it, got over there and straightened him out and just told him that he couldn't talk about his hand.
Now he still fought
afterwards about it and saying that, you know, that's still wrong. But at the time, I think he was a little more upset about the ruling in the first place. And, you know, we've had this conversation go around and around and done many interviews about it. But basically, like I've said before, you know, when all tournament directors need to protect all situations, it's very hard for them to know who's friends, who's playing with each other,
right,
who's backed each other. So you need to protect those players as well as the $10,000 events. In my tournaments, I've said it before, I have no problem with people talking a little bit more because I know the situation. I can go to the table and make a determination if these two guys are stop playing or not.
Mm-hmm.
In other situations, it's not fair for those tournament directors who don't know everybody to handle those situations. So to make it fair across the board, we've instituted that rule, and it's worked just fine. I really haven't had any issue with it since the World Series Poker.
But clarify, what does that mean? You can't talk about your hand?
You cannot disclose the contents of your hand with action pending. So you cannot say what you have in your hand. You cannot tell the truth. You cannot tell a lie. You just can't talk about what you have in your hand.
But could I say to you, if you're my opponent, you have two pair here because
that's
two pair
fine.
Is good.
100% fine.
Yeah. As long as I don't say, look, I've got ace king.
It's 100% fine.
Yeah.
You've got it nailed.
That clarifies it for a lot of people. I just saved you about 100 Twitter questions.
Yeah, probably. I don't mind. I like answering them.
That's Matt Savage, who's the tournament director for the World Poker Tour and the Epic Poker League and the Los Angeles Poker Classic, which is going on now and for the next month or more at the Commerce Casino out in L.A. He also does Bay 101, one of the busiest guys. Dennis was talking earlier about Jimmy Sommerfeld's schedule. I think Matt Savage may have one that rivals it with all the stuff that he does and on a global basis as well.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. Everywhere you go, you seem to run into Matt. And how he stays on top of all this stuff, I'll never know. You had talked beforehand about some of the changes, and now you've got a bounty one. And I love bounty tournaments, by the way. But this is just an awesome time to be playing poker, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, wow, what more could you ask for? It's growing by leaps and bounds. There's a variety of, and new twists and turns in the game. Everywhere you go, there's poker being played. We definitely, I think, it hit the right time to be playing.
You know, I think that the moneymaker effect, which made poker explode, had two different effects on poker. One was it got a lot of people interested in the game in the first place who may not have been. They got to see it on TV, and that brought them into live games in the casinos. And, of course, there was the online element because that's how Chris got in there. You got in through a live tournament event here at Harrah's St. Louis, but he got in with like a $39 thing on PokerStars and ended up getting in there, and that helped it explode in terms of online. Then it grew and grew and grew, and then it kind of plateaued a little bit a couple of years ago, and it was still very strong. But then Black Friday hit, and everybody said, oh, this is going to be horrible for poker. This is going to be one of the death knells for poker. I actually think that while we've lost the online poker element, we're seeing a boom in the live poker element. We certainly are seeing it in more people coming out and playing in cash games and the tournaments that we talked about before.
I agree with you on that. I think it just shows you the strength of poker and how much enjoyment there is and how many millions of people are playing it and enjoying it. And I think maybe that'll resonate all the way to Washington. At least I hope the heck it does. When this legislation gets passed this year, and I'm going to say when, the same as the chairman from the MGM said, and they start doing this state by state, and there's lots we could talk about that, but as that gets developed, maybe not this year, but next year, you're going to see some monstrous tournaments being conducted, including up to and including the World Series of Poker, I think. You're just going to see it explode again because you're going to have now online qualifiers combined with these massive changes in the live. You put the two of them back together, the sky's the limit. Now, you're going to see some huge fields.
Now, when it comes to the online element, we talked a few times towards the end of last year about Zynga. They're the people who do Words with Friends and Farmville and Mafia Wars, and they also have their online free-to-play poker site. You can do it on your phone. You can do it on Facebook. They have 7 million people playing poker online every day. Play money. 30 million people a month. Their CEO was interviewed towards the end of last year in the fourth quarter and said, when asked, are you interested in getting into real money gaming, he said no. Well, just a couple of days ago, another spokesperson for Zynga said, you know what? Yes, we are interested in it because we have found out that our players want it. And so they have had discussions, they say, or at least this spokesperson says, with several potential partners. Now, I don't know what that means, but I think that this is one of those companies, because of the Facebook connection, that could be another game changer for poker. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. And back when we had the discussion, if you remember, they claimed that they made, I think, a profit of around $85
million. $85 million with nobody playing cash games or tournaments against each other for much of anything, although you can buy these virtual coins to get yourself more, just like you do in all of their other games. But nobody's wagering against each other.
No, they had affiliations, they had advertising, they had chips to buy, they had a variety of different streams of revenue, and they were in netting bringing in $85 million. What we said, I think, was, and let's see, if you do the online, you can add at least another zero to the back end of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to get involved. This is not exactly a major surprise that he comes out and says, oh, we may get involved after all. They will be a huge game changer. But you're going to see several of those in the U.S. You are going to have MGM doing something. You're going to have Harrah's doing something or Caesars Entertainment. You're going to have people like Zynga. You could, you name a major company that's all involved or can get involved in this, and they will be involved in this. It's just, if you look back a year from now, look back and see what the changes are, I think you'd be totally amazed.
What's amazing to me is that it's happening so quickly, and a lot of that comes because of the Department of Justice letter that was released around Christmas time about the 1961 Wire Act not applying to online poker. And just a few hours after we finished our show last week, a state senator in Iowa by the name of Jeff Danielson announced that he's drafting a bill right now which would legalize online poker in Iowa. We've talked about Nevada probably being one of the bellwether states and leading the way on this, and they certainly are ahead of other states. Jeff Danielson doesn't want Iowa to be left behind, and he thinks that the DOJ's decision could allow states like Iowa to join other jurisdictions like Nevada and other states that are considering this and link up, as we have said before, under something similar to the way Powerball does it.
It absolutely will. There'll be compromises, compacts, whatever, between the different states, and you may end up with 20, 30, 40 states all banded together to do this within the U.S. and outside of the U.S. And if you have a state like, there's very few now that don't allow anything, but Hawaii or Utah or something that wants to opt out of it, that doesn't want to get involved in it, that wants to, for whatever reason, they don't want the revenue, then that'll happen. But I think they're going to be few and far between. I predict that within 2 years, 80% of the states will have some sort of online poker playing going on.
Within 2 years?
Within 2 years.
Wow.
How's that for a game changer?
I think that is a tremendous game changer. And then comes your real poker boom, as you were saying before.
Yes.
Watch how many people are entered in the main event in 2014, and maybe it'll take till 2015 for that to happen.
I think you're going to see a major change. I predict in 24 months you're going to have most of the states having some sort of an approval and allowing the online gaming. And I think you're right. It may not be next summer. It won't be this summer. It may not be next summer. But about 3 World Series from now, I think they're going to have to build another tower at the Rio.
Well, that'll take the entries well over 10,000 and possibly, if we really boom, to 15,000. And can you imagine if Jack Effel decided that the main event was going to be a re-entry event, like the main events would be circuit events? first of all, again, you're going to be talking about a lot of people who would not have the bankroll to be able to do more than one buy-in, and most of the people would be qualifying to get there. But you would have pros. I mean, look, Jonathan Duhamel rebought in a 100K event at the PCA. You would have pros who would rebuy in a 10K main event because the field would be so soft, there would be so much dead money out there. And with that, you're talking about getting well over 15,000 people in the main.
Well, again, re-entries are still kind of in their infancy. It looks like on a medium to a low tournament, you can get an extra 10 to 12% of the people rebuying, a big, big number. When you get into these monstrous ones, you're looking more like maybe 5% that would be rebuying, re-entering.
And by the way, it will affect it. I think it would be a mistake to make the main event a rebuy. I like the purity of keeping it at 10K, which it's always been. Keep it there. Don't worry about inflation. Don't worry about rebuys or re-entries or that sort of thing. Just have one tournament that's always going to be the $10,000 World Poker Championship event.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly, unless I lose set over set in the first level or something.
Ace King versus Ace King, as we saw you do in 2009. Good story on PokerNews.com in the last couple of days about the man who bought Peter Eastgate's bracelet. Speaking of World Series of Poker main events, Peter, of course, is the guy who won it in 2008, the year he and Dennis were both part of the November 9. Dennis finished third, Ivan Demidov second. Peter Eastgate won the whole thing. And then last year, Peter auctioned it off for a charity to help out some kids in Africa, and ended up raising nearly $150,000, but we never knew who the buyer was. Now we do. It's a Scottish entrepreneur named William Hoy, who's a recreational poker player, just picked up the game about 6 years ago, does a lot of charitable stuff, very, very charitable guy. He says now he wants to give the bracelet back to the WSOP so they could kind of put it in a Hall of Fame or a museum or someplace, and then he wants them to run a charity tournament so somebody else can win the bracelet. He says maybe do a $100 buy-in, and if you include, you know, European players or outside the U.S., you can do an online component to this, get thousands of players to do it, and he says he will match whatever they raise, up to $1 million. Half of the money raised would go to a charity that the WSOP wants, the other half would go to a cancer hospital that he supports that's being built now in the U.K. He says he's kept quiet about his identity until now because he's not in it for the fame. He doesn't care if no one ever knows his name. He just wants to help and use the money for good things. He says, I would never have paid $150,000 for this bracelet. I probably wouldn't have paid $50,000 if it weren't going for charity. So that's the kind of guy we're talking about here. What do you think about the idea of recycling the bracelet back into the poker community via another charity event?
I absolutely love it, and I would love to get involved in figuring something with it. He's got, I believe it's a cancer hospital. It's going to be built in the UK that he wants to raise funds for. He said the other half can go to whatever WSOP charity that they want. This is a great way. People don't realize how much poker players give back to the community. I read an article that the number one fundraiser for charities right now, it isn't bingo night. It isn't any of these others. It's poker night.
Yep.
That more money is raised through the fun of playing poker for these charities than any other activity, period. What a great way to do this. What a great way to rebuild that poker reputation that may have been tarnished some for some of the actions that have happened here in the last year. I wholeheartedly back it, and you know, would love to see something like this develop.
Yep, me too. While we're talking about charity events, here's one that one of our listeners asked me to mention here in St. Louis. There's going to be a charity poker tournament for Friends of Kids with Cancer. It ties in with just what we were talking about. Friends of Kids with Cancer having a charity event Thursday night, February 2nd. That would be Groundhog Day. It's going to be at the Baldwin Memorial VFW Hall. The doors will open at 6:30. The tournament will start at 7:30. It's a $25 buy-in and includes food or beverage. I hope that they make it a rebuy event because you'll get a lot of people who will go there and buy in more than once for the $25. If you want information on this, you can go to the website friendsofkids.com. Again, if you're in the St. Louis area, charity poker event, low buy-in, probably going to be a great night, and they'll raise thousands of dollars for Friends of Kids with Cancer. Again, the website is friendsofkids.com. All right, we're all out of time for this week, but a reminder that you can download any of our shows via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or listen to them by going to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. We're live every Tuesday afternoon at 3 on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Dennis, are you staying home for a while? No travels in the next week or so?
Not for the next short period of time. In fact, I'm guilty of this, I need to sit down and go through the calendar and figure out exactly. Well, I've been invited to a dozen different things, and I got a feeling some of them are overlapping, and I need to get on the ball and get my calendar set up. That's for sure.
Unfortunately, that means that Dennis won't be traveling this weekend when we're having the big game here, but he does have an excuse. It's his girlfriend's birthday this weekend. Wish her a very happy birthday for me.
I will, definitely.
For those of you coming to St. Louis this weekend, come play in or watch Big Game 2. It starts Friday night at 6, the $15,000 buy-in cash event. Not a tournament, but a cash game. We're playing again here at Harrah's St. Louis in the World Series of Poker Room. Until next time, I'm Paul Harrah's. He's Dennis Phillips. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show.